Stay tuned for The Lid Show. Today, I'm playing an interview I did with Johnny Epstein. Johnny is a Shakespearean player who shares his love of and knowledge of Shakespeare with his students at the FSU Conservatory for Actor Training in Sarasota, Florida, and currently has directed them in a production of As You Like It. Johnny's story is interesting because it took a shop teacher to tell him that acting was his profession. But once he recognized that, he took it in both hands and has never let go and is sharing his passion for it and his knowledge of it with his students. It's an interesting interview. Hang on. Here come the show.
Inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can.
Show is about you and me and all of us, about recognizing that most of us are demonstrating a person who is not our whole self. It's about recognizing that childhood quite often forces us in one way or another to deny important aspects of ourselves, and that life is easier, more fulfilling when we are able to demonstrate all of who we are, when we are able not to be in denial for any aspect of ourselves, no matter how much resistance we got to that aspect of ourselves when we were children. In my show, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. I do this because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. And it is my hope that when you hear the passion, the commitment, the certainty in these interviews, that you are inspired to ask yourself, did I leave something behind? Is this how I feel about my life? Could I possibly be more of who I am? So today my interview, as I said in the run-up, is with Johnny Epstein, who always knew he was comfortable on stage. You'll hear him talk about his earliest experiences. But as I also said in the run-up, it took a man with not that much knowledge of theater to point out to Johnny that he was moved by Johnny's performance. And that put Johnny on the track, which we are all glad that he took. So here, in his own words, is Johnny Epstein. I'm here with Johnny Epstein, who is directing
As You Like It with the Oslo Conservatory. The second year MFA students do four plays during the year in the Cook Theater at the Oslo.
And this is the second
this
one?
This is the second. Water Engine just closed, that Greg Lemming directed. And so it's a big transition from them doing David Mamet to doing William Shakespeare.
Yes, it is. And you also teach here.
I do. I teach these same actors. And we've spent now the last 2 months and a half working on Shakespeare, and most of this year they'll be doing Shakespeare with me. So it's a luxury for me to be able to work on a full play with them, because there's a lot of things I can tell them about. And by and large, you're doing working with two people in a scene or four people in a scene, or last year we did essentially the fourth act of Merchant of Venice, but that's as big a chunk as you can get in a class. And so to be able to do a whole play, especially a play that I love and know well, that's a real luxury.
That's great. Okay, so I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. That clearly is true of you. Mm-hmm. The art of acting. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
Yeah.
And I only ask one question, and that is, do you remember the very first moment in your life when acting, getting people's attention, telling stories, being looked at, any of that attracted you, called you, became
Yes, I do. I do. I remember a couple. I remember the very first, and the first, the very first was in second grade, and I was playing the king in a play called roughly something about Give Her the Moon, you know, and the princess wants the moon, and so on. And somebody forgot an entrance. And so we had rehearsed, you know. I don't know how advanced this work was, but we had done a lot of rehearsing, and someone forgot an entrance, and I ad-libbed.
And how old were you?
In second grade, I was the youngest in my class, so how old are you in second grade? I was a year younger. So
Seven or eight, probably. And you ad-libbed until...
I was seven. I would have been seven.
Right,
I was 17 in 12th grade. I ad-libbed. My mother remembers it for half an hour. It was probably a minute or two. But I remember that that felt completely natural, that I didn't feel any...
It wasn't stressful, it wasn't scary,
it came completely naturally
to you.
No, I've been subject to stage fright, as most people experience stage fright, only once, and that was many, many years later with it was a role that anybody would have been scared of, and I was.
Well, we'll get there. So that's the first time.
The first one, but the reason I think of it is, I remember when I first thought I could do it as a profession, and I had just played the first time I did As You Like It in high school. I was in 11th grade, and I was playing a small role. I was playing Corin, the rustic shepherd, which I did with a strong, I thought it was an English accent. It probably wasn't, really. But it was, you know, and I had built myself a crepe hair beard that looked a lot like the beard I have now, and I took it really seriously.
Oh, wait a minute now. This is a leap from second grade
to 11th grade.
To 11th grade. So does that mean that in between you did nothing?
No, I did a lot of theater, you know, and I loved theater. I went, one of the things that, she may even hear the show, my first director was a woman named Iris Fanger, my first professional director. I was enrolled in a summer camp at Tufts.
Wait. How old were you?
This is when I would have been eight the next year after that.
Oh, you know. so now let me just see if I get this. So you do this thing,
yeah.
And you say, I really like this. Is there a summer camp, or your mother says?
Not at all.
No?
No, not at all.
What happened?
What happened was I was afraid of the water due to a traumatic experience when I was six, and I was unwilling to swim. I wouldn't go in the water above my ankles. my parents thought, well, we have to get past this. We have to find a summer camp he can go to that's a day camp that has swimming. And the only one that they liked the looks of was the Tufts Magic Circle, which did theater in the morning and had swimming in the afternoon.
I see. So it's an accident.
It's a complete accident. That part is a complete accident. And the woman who ran it is a remarkable woman, still thriving, named Iris Fanger. There are, I can't remember, she would be able to tell you, there are many of us in the business still whose first experience of theater was that. And in fact, one of the young men in the first year class, Jake Sherburn, teaches in that institution, Tufts Magic Circle. So I would take the bus from Cambridge up to Medford and act in the morning and then avoid swimming in the afternoon. And I did that for about 3 years.
You managed to avoid swimming?
As for a while. You know, after a while they just had enough and they, you know, and that was frightening. I love the water. I'm still afraid of the water. I go windsurfing out on Sarasota Bay, and every time I fall in, I have a little moment of six-year-old panic.
Yeah, I think that stuff doesn't actually go away.
Evidently not. People get past most phobia, but that particular
That doesn't
one,
mean they don't get scared.
No.
You know, I mean, you got past it because you can do stuff like that,
I
but
can,
that doesn't mean you don't
work.
Get scared.
But it
right?
takes work. And the sea, one of the things about the sea, if you're a Shakespeare player, any mention of the sea is an invocation of the subconscious. Of the unconscious.
Really?
And so, yes, anytime.
Now, you know this is true, psychologically speaking, so...
No kidding.
So Shakespeare way ahead of his time? Is that what you're
Shakespeare,
saying?
Well, a lot of... Freud is reluctant...
To give credit
to Shakespeare.
...to acknowledge
how much he owes to Shakespeare.
Wow.
But he quotes him a lot. And of Freud's disciples, a lot of them are Shakespeareans and come at it via Shakespeare. But yes, my bounty is as boundless as the sea.
Mm-hmm.
My love as deep, the more I give to thee, the more I have, do you know?
Yeah.
Or Rosalind in As You Like It, my affection hath an unknown bottom like the Bay of Portugal.
Yeah.
Or rather, bottomless, says Celia, for as fast as you pour affection in, it runs out. The infinite capacity of the sea for depth is a metaphor for the infinite capacity of the unconscious for self-examination and,
yeah.
and so on.
Yeah, it's great.
So
it's an interesting thing for you as an actor, especially someone so interested in Shakespeare, to be afraid of the sea.
Yeah, no kidding. Because
I don't have to make this leap. Right?
No, not really. But it is the case that I don't get stage fright in the sense that most people mean stage fright, the paralytic sort of nausea-inducing. But it is the case that if I go on without an edge, without a sense of dread of the depths, then I know I'm not ready to walk on stage, and I do some very hard work in the 5 minutes before I go on to get my edge, to get a sense of dread of the depths. Otherwise, my work's going to be shallow as an actor.
Can you be a little bit more specific about what that, how that works or what that is?
Yeah, I try to do it without intruding on any of it. I mean, As You Like It, I need to be careful of my actors. When you know a play as well as I know that, this is going to be my sixth As You Like It.
Wow.
You have a responsibility to stay out of your actors the way of their imagination to some extent.
Because they have to get there themselves.
They have to get where they're going to get.
That's what I mean.
They need to not get where I got.
That's what I mean.
Exactly.
You can't
That's
tell them
exactly.
where to go.
No.
Right.
No, that's exactly it.
Well, but we're not in danger of that now.
No, not particularly. They don't have time to listen to the radio. If you think about the first role I did as a professional and As You Like It was Jaques, and his first word is more. And his second word is more. And then he says, I prithee more. And so... How greedy am I for experience? And could I be even more greedy? And if I got that experience, would I still want more? And what would it be like to have that kind of unsatisfiable yearning?
So that's what you're aiming for before.
If I'm not in the condition, in that condition,
yeah.
I need to do some work in a hurry. Otherwise, the audience isn't going to get the full experience of what Jaques is, which is a man voraciously in love with extremity.
So you're trying to find that in yourself.
Yeah. Do it by going, well, what's in the way, you know, or what haven't I thought of today, or what's the first thing I think of? You do all the things probably that an analyst would do with you over a period of 6 or 7 years.
Right.
You do between 5 minute and places.
If you haven't done it before.
If it happens not to be kicking in, you've done it before. You've done it for months.
Right.
You know, I mean, in the aggregate, I've rehearsed As You Like It for 1 year, you know, in the aggregate of those 5, now 6 productions. But I have to do it tonight.
Again.
Because tonight's...
Tonight's the
otherwise
performance,
tonight's
right.
not. Otherwise tonight's not any different than those other nights. And that's the thing that people don't understand about. You know, people always ask about, how do you remember all those lines? Which is really the easiest thing, really, that we do. Working my way back to the second time.
Yeah, that's good. Thank you.
We did plays at Tufts. We never did a full Shakespeare play. We did a Jacobean play called The Old Wives' Tale. And we did some musicals. We did Once Upon a Mattress.
You sing?
I sang. I still sing. I don't sing the way Broadway singers sing. I sing for pleasure. And other people don't run away when I sing. I did sing, but I was very young, and so all the double entendre was full of single entendre for me, because I didn't get, you know,
when it,
I said,
jokes.
None of the ladies are getting any younger. I thought it meant they were getting older. I had no idea that not getting any was a thing, because I was 8, you know. But gradually, I caught up on it. But we did As You Like It when I was in 10th grade. I was playing this small role, and I worked really hard on it.
You worked really hard on it.
Well, I worked hard on creating the character, on creating his appearance, on creating, I was 15, on making myself look like an old country shepherd.
Okay, wait. I'm sorry. I got the ages wrong. I thought you went the following summer after 8.
Yeah. So I'm 8 in 7,
oh, so
in second grade, and
right.
When I'm 8, I go to Tufts Magic Circle.
Right.
And then some years later.
Yes.
As a passage of time.
You see
the calendar flipping.
Right.
Little screen.
You're there for several years. That's what you're saying.
I was there for 3 years, and then I went to high school, and I did a little acting in high school. But the first Shakespeare play I did, full Shakespeare play I did, was As You Like It.
Well, okay, but I have a question now. By the time you did the role in As You Like It, you already understood that acting was not just about getting on stage and saying the lines.
Oh, yeah.
Right. So, when did that happen? Do you know what I mean? I mean, you didn't choose to go to Tufts, so it wasn't, it didn't come from you. But then at some point, you got captured by what it really is. Do you know what I'm asking?
Yeah, bit by bit, and I'm still being captured bit by bit by what it really is, and I understand what it really is differently today than yesterday. You know, I mean, I had a...
Well, wait, let's not be so, I mean, this is much more simplistic what I'm asking.
Yes.
A lot of kids who would have gone to that camp might have gone because they wanted to be on stage, because they wanted people to look at them, because their parents wanted them to go, whatever. And so, admittedly, lots of them went on to be in the business, but something happened to them that captured them. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Sure. I think one of the things that they were particularly good at, and this was Iris Fanger, was giving the students the sensation that they were in a sacred space, that the space had sanctity and therefore, by implication, was deserving of honor at a level that had nothing to do with the honor that might accrue to you from being applauded. I think, like most experienced actors, the hardest part of the show is the applause. That's the hardest to take. But I remember it came out of being scolded one time. We had a very short break between our first performance and our second performance, in which time we had to go to the cafeteria at Tufts and get lunch. And so we rushed over to the cafeteria and got lunch without taking our makeup off. And we got reamed out. You never let people see you in your makeup outside the stage. That you never do that. And it's still a problem for me. You know, if I mean, now, since I mostly have always played middle-aged men, and I actually am a middle-aged man, I don't have to wear that much makeup anymore. But it's really hard for me if someone comes by to see me, and I have a very hard time leaving the dressing room if I still have any makeup on, based on that. Well, that the idea that this theater is a place where stuff happens that doesn't happen anywhere else, it's the only place you're allowed to show people yourself in makeup, that the character belongs in the theater, he never leaves the theater with you, those kinds of things, that probably is a big part of the creation of the idea of the thing as a sacred space. And it's sacred to Iris in one way, it's sacred to my other, I would say the most important teacher in my life is Tina Packer, in another way, and it's sacred to me in quite a different way from the way it is to them.
But what I hear you saying is that not only is the space special, mm-hmm. but you are special in it.
Yeah.
That you are part of this thing that doesn't exist mm-hmm. outside of this. And there's I don't know, we're gonna find another word for special, but there's a power in that, no?
Yeah. Yeah, if you think about the name theater, it's the Greek word is theatron, right? And we have that word thea also in theology.
Yes.
Which is the study of God. And then we have also the same word in therapy, which is the healing of God. And also the being seized by God. Rapon is this strange Greek word which has the sense of taking. And it is... So the supplicant would go to the temple and they would be given hallucinogenic drugs and then they would be taken by the priest into the holy place where they would dream. And then their dream would be interpreted and they would be healed. That rapon, taking, you know, that's the same word in rapture and therapy and rape. It's the same word, seizing.
Mm-hmm.
And we have this thing, theater. And so there's a kind of priestliness in the act of being a theater practitioner, and a kind of godliness in it, too. You're associated with it. It was, in the earliest days, intrinsic to the religion. The Greeks, which is really where Western theater was founded, the festival days were holy days, and you were required to show up in the same way as you were required in Elizabethan England, not to go to the theater, but to go to church.
Okay, so this happened to you. You got seized.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I think you said that it was in this role that it began to occur to you that this might be a work for you.
Yeah, it didn't occur to me. It was told to me.
Oh.
I mean, you know, I was walking down the hallway and the shop teacher, not an educated man, a very plain man. So he said, I saw that As You Like It. You're a great actor.
My goodness.
Is that going to be your profession?
My goodness.
You know, and...
Deus ex machina.
Yeah. Yeah. And it had never occurred to me that it was a profession. I knew that there were professional actors, but it was not one of the things that when I thought about what do I want to do, acting was not crazy because I'd done, you know, by that time a couple of dozen plays, more certainly than most people. But that was the first time that it occurred to me that I could actually do it as a profession. And it was because this guy had been moved by it. You know, a very plain man, and I would be surprised if he'd seen 10 Shakespeare plays in his long life, which he was relatively near the end of. He's no longer alive. You know, not a literate man, a very plain man. but had been moved by a performance of Shakespeare.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
So, okay, so this this idea is planted, and then, I mean, you're running now on a time when you're going to go to college, right? Mm-hmm. So are you thinking about that? Have you, is that?
Yeah, yeah. I didn't want to go to college to train to be an actor, and I don't think I'd made the decision to be an actor. I'm quite sure I hadn't. I know when I went to college, they said, "What's your major?" It was math and physics.
Really?
Yeah, I was adept at that stuff, what I found out freshman year was that I spent all my time, you know, in the theater, and none of my time doing physics homework.
Well, this must have come as a big surprise to your family then.
Well, no, I think they knew I was, you know, a good actor.
But they didn't know you were seized.
I don't think I expected to be an actor for as long as I have been. I thought that I would start directing pretty early.
Oh, well, stop then. So you understood what it meant to be a director. And what made you, what attracted you about that?
Well, because I had, certainly at that time, a rather analytic sort of mind.
Math and physics.
Yeah. And although those things, for the practitioners of it, are a lot more right-brained than... People who aren't comfortable with math think of it as a left-brain activity. People who are comfortable with math think of it as music. And so it's very, very... And in fact, it you know, when they do studies of mathematicians...
They all play instruments.
Many of them play instruments.
I know.
Almost all chess players play instruments. Mm-hmm. Most musicians are not too bad at, you know, and so on. And their brain, the activity is just flashing back and forth. Mm-hmm. So it's, I would say, more than it being right or left brain, I'd say it's a synthetic activity where the ability to go back and forth is really important. But those things didn't.
So, okay, your freshman year, you say to yourself,
yeah,
oh, my God, I'm spending all this time in the theater.
In the theater. And so I switched my concentration from math and physics. You don't have to declare till sophomore year, to English. We didn't have a theater program. And I studied with really, really great scholars.
English,
almost all. I mean, yes, you have to study, but I mean, I was studying Elizabethan, Jacobean drama was what I was studying.
Right, right. But not acting.
I was doing a lot of acting because there was a very, very active undergraduate amateur tradition. So I did, basically, you know, I did well in school if I only did one play in a term. If I did two, I was going to flunk some course because I just wouldn't do any work. You know, so my record in college was all A's and F's, depending on how many plays I was doing that particular term. And so we did a lot, and I got a little training. There was one acting class freshman year that I took, and that was the only acting class in the whole curriculum. Now there are a few more. And by the end of that time, I really felt that I had a calling towards classical theater and really towards Shakespeare. I expected it to be as a director because I knew that I was not improvisational enough. I was too stiff, really, to be anything but a good tragedian. I wasn't a good comedian. And so if you want access to the whole canon, you're going to have to find some way that, you know, you can get in the door. I wasn't going to play Festi or Touchstone or Dogberry or even Falstaff because I just wasn't loose enough to be funny.
And you knew that?
I knew that then. It turns out not to be true. I learned how. Mm-hmm. You know, and I've played all those roles, some of them more than once. That happened later when I, years later, really. I went after college. I thought, the English know everything about this, I'm going to go to acting school in England. Because what I really want to do is be a Shakespearean. And they may know everything about it, but they weren't sharing it with me. I went to a school that was really not a good experience. And they actually threw me out, which was probably a good thing for me. It was not as good a school as the Oslo.
But that must have been...
After a year. It was shocking because, to be honest, it was just... I really haven't failed at anything before.
Yes.
You know, except, you know, winning football games. My high school had a very bad football team. But it wasn't... It didn't feel like...
No, I'm sure this was pretty shocking.
This was a shock, you know. And I can see, in retrospect, you know, I must have been just insufferable. You know, Dave Van Ronk. So I must have been the most... Dave Van Ronk, the great musician. I was the most insufferable jazz snob. I hated folk music with a passion. You know, and of course he's best known now as the father of the modern folk music movement. I had spent 4 years in the offices of the greatest Shakespeare scholars in the world, arguing with them one to one. On more or less equal footing, I didn't understand that you can't do that with an English acting teacher of more than a certain age. It just is not going to work.
No.
They're there to tell you what they know. They're not there to find out what you're interested in.
Well, to have you correct them.
Yeah, I don't think I did too much of that, you know, but I definitely knew what I was interested in. And it wasn't always so. And lucky for me in a way, because, I mean, now I'm able to teach... in a way of my job is to open up doors so the actors can go through them, not to take them by the hand and, you know,
push them.
For them to find out which, you know, to find out which doors it is that they need opened that I can help them open for themselves. So communication of information or technique or how to do it right, these are all things that I spend a lot of time inviting them to get out of their minds. So I want them to get beyond the idea that there is a way to do it right.
Yeah.
And that's really hard. It's really hard in this society where you think, you know, there is a proper way to do things, and especially in a very, very marginal profession, which classical theater acting is at the moment, you think you have to be perfect at it and brilliant.
And whatever perfect is.
Yeah.
So they throw you out. Now you're in England.
I came back,
right.
And I got lucky. I was invited to play bridge with a well-known director. I was a good bridge player. And he called me the next day, John, you know, it's crazy, but you can do an Indian accent, right? Yeah, because I have a good ear. And even the horrible teachers in England knew that I had a good ear. You have a good ear, and you know, maybe you could be a director. We don't think you could be an actor. And a student of mine years later had gone to the same school, and they said, well, maybe you could be a stage manager.
Dear.
Well, she was a woman.
Right.
So she couldn't be a director. You know, yeah, they really
right,
were
right.
bad teachers.
They may have tried
to throw me out, but they really were bad teachers. But he calls me up. They need someone to play an Indian from India. And understudy all the English and Irish roles.
Oi!
And he knew that I could do English and Irish accents, and if only I was willing to paint myself dark and go on stage with a bunch of actual guys from India, I could do this role, which was a Broadway show.
Huh? What was it?
It was called A Meeting by the River. It was a play by Christopher Isherwood and Don Bacardi.
Goodness.
It featured people that you and I have heard of, like Sam Jaffe and Siobhan McKenna and Keith Baxter and Simon Ward and the lovely Megwyn Owen and a bunch of other guys who've since become famous or not. Who else?
So this is how you get...
This is how I got my equity card.
I was just going to say, painted, on Broadway.
Painted, you know, a comely shade of green, and speaking all my lines were in Sanskrit because I was playing a Hindu monk. I never got to go on for the guys... Because the play didn't run long enough.
Yeah.
We ran closed after opening night.
It did what it was supposed to do for you.
It did. Well, it got me an equity card, and I lived on the, you know, in those days, I forget what the equity salary was, but it was a hell of a lot more than I'd ever made.
Right.
I think I was getting $600 a week, which was a lot of money in 1979 for, you know, a kid my age. It was very gratifying when there was a reunion of the survivors of my acting school and they asked me what I was doing, and I was able to tell them I was doing a show at the Palace. Where is that? It's on 47th Street, 47th and Broadway.
I'm on Broadway.
I took a kind of sadistic leap out of that. I didn't tell them that all my lines were in Sanskrit in blackouts, which is pretty much the case.
So was this a launch pad for you, or...?
In a sense, because this director, Albert Marr, now the late, great Albert Marr, had been the first director, he was the creative director of Man of La Mancha.
Oh.
And some years later, including 9 months here at the Oslo during the tour, which in those days was an equity tour, which toured all over Florida. Now they do Shakespeare plays. We did three. It was run by Linda DeGabriel, the tour was, and she now runs the whole shoot and magic course. Some years later, he calls me up with about this, and John, it's crazy time, but can you can sing a little, right? You know, and he hired me in. He'd lost an actor, and he needed someone to replace him, playing a very small role in Man of La Mancha. And as it happened, I didn't know at the time, this was the last time that Richard Kiley ever did Man of La Mancha.
Oh.
So I was on stage with Richard Kiley for 10 shows, which was very, very memorable. Richard Kiley was so good, you could not look at him on stage because you would start crying.
Oh.
You just couldn't look. He was too touching. And they, I have some great stories about that. But one time or another during my life of making myself a career as a Shakespearean, you know, I'd be really broke living on 83rd Street, and I'd get a John, you know, we're in Phoenix, and it's crazy, you know. And it would be Albie again, who had an actor who couldn't understand him. And since his directions tended to go, when the little girl, you know, can you, out of which you were supposed to understand that you were supposed to lean forward over the bed, not cut off her line, but pick up the cue pretty well and make sure, you know, you threw it over to this other actor. And that literally is what he meant by it.
Wow.
And for whatever reason, maybe because we went to the same college or something, I actually understood this complete mishmash, which was mostly groans, really. And so it happened several times. I would be doing some play, and he'd call me, John. I go, no, I'm doing this play. I go, okay. And he goes, you know, my play would close, and 6 weeks later, you know, Albie would be on the, it's just, you know, and he would bring me in to rescue whatever role.
Right.
I'm sure the actor, usually, I mean, several very good actors, you know, were doing fine, but Albie was making him crazy. So, in a sense, it kept me in the business because unlike, you know, Measure for Measure in a Hole in the Wall theater on East 18th Street,
right.
Man of La Mancha actually paid you money.
Yes, it did. Yes, it did.
And it was not really acting. It was recapitulating. But it was acting adjacent. It was acting view. You know, it was a sure steps to acting. It was, you know, like they
it was
say
in the presence of acting,
that's
too.
Right. It was a short bus ride, you know, it was like, and there were a lot of people who, you know, so.
Well, and you're building a resume here.
In a sense, although it's not a resume that actually will get me any doors I want to get in, because anybody who was casting a musical was going to cast someone who sang a lot better than I did.
Right.
I remember I wasn't playing Quixote, I was playing, you know, Dr. Carrasco usually. Although the first time memorably I did that show, I was Captain of the Inquisition. I'll tell you one good story about that. In that show had been started at the Goodspeed and then played at Anta and then eventually went to Broadway. And by the way, Man of La Mancha was hammered by the critics every step of the way.
Wow.
Every step of the way. It was, and people couldn't stay away from it, but the critics, it took them a long time to get the memo. And even though Kiley was a wonderful actor and Joan Diener was a fantastic singer and so on, it was a pretty good cast altogether, it was just hammered. It was very radical for the time. Mm-hmm. It was a very unusual stage. It was a play within the play. It was there was all kinds of interesting technological innovations. Mitch Lee and Joe Darien had done a remarkable job on the script, and Albie had done a great job directing it, but it was getting hammered. And as with most musicals, people were constantly getting sick. And so everybody had to be able to play several roles. So the captain of the Inquisition was always played by someone who could do either the innkeeper or the chief muleteer, Pedro, or the barber, or all three. In other words, a good singer.
Right.
They cast me because they lost an actor. They pulled me out of another production that had just closed. Oh, John, was in Boston. And I never rehearsed it with Dick. I rehearsed it with a stage manager. So I said my first line, which is the first line of the play, and then he said his, and I said mine, and he said his, and I said mine, and there's a silence. And I know it's his turn, but there's no way in the world that I'm going to step in on Richard Kiley if he happens to be having an acting moment here.
Right.
And eventually we pick up the rhythm again, and I think, oh, that was great. I just got fired after my first performance, just like being in acting school. And Dick never used to say, this is one of the best compliments I ever got in my life. He never used to talk backstage because his concentration was so deep. And it wasn't any kind of affectation. I mean, he had a towel over his head, and he was nowhere. You probably could have taken his pulse. It would have been about 30 because he was so deeply into the role. And he goes, oh, Terry, came over to talk to me. I'm like, oh, God, this is really terribly sorry. Is it Jonathan? I said, yes, sir. Said, well, I know it was my turn, but for 18 years they've been casting singers in that role. It's the first time they cast an actor. I was so busy acting with you, I forgot it was my turn. Which I thought, even at that age of 23 or 4, even then I knew that I just had about the best compliment I was ever going to get to have a master actor say I was an actor at all. So that felt really...
Oh, that's lovely.
Isn't that nice? Very gracious. There was no reason why I had to do it.
Right.
But he had been. He'd been acting with me. We'd had a moment of real communication on stage, and he'd forgotten.
Right. He wasn't acting.
No.
He was in it.
He was. But this is, it's still, I don't think I refer back to that moment very often, except when I need a good story for some reason, but it is a good story, and it's relevant because the moment when an actor goes up, the beginner thinks it's a failure. The actor knows that's where the door is.
Yes.
You just didn't walk through it. That there's a new door that you haven't found, and it's right there in that moment.
Wow.
So when an actor in my class doesn't know their line, what I'm really interested in is what was going on a half a second ago.
Right. Where were you?
Because that's where the scene actually is. And most of them get that. The word you always get wrong. It's not wrong. It's that you're not ready for the real word. What would it take to get you ready to say what the real line is? What's the difference between what your paraphrase and what the actual line is? Because in that difference is the whole core of the scene. And sometimes you'll have huge, huge revelations out of this. And sometimes you'll just go, nah, I don't want to do that line.
Yeah, I don't want to go
actually
there.
Change the line. No.
Right.
Or you'll hiccup over it. But you'll get actors who can't, when you persistently get a word wrong, when you persistently forget a line, it's just a big old firework saying you're not aligned with the role yet.
Wow.
And so that's really good information for an actor.
Yeah.
And that silence was, that's where that scene had wanted to be for 18 years.
Yes.
And remember, it was in silence. So now what's the scene? The scene is about these two people trying to communicate and failing. And that is
so
what
you
that
have silence. Right.
So you have silence. And we had silence. So we, so,
so
what
that's
we
right.
found, that it was right. Mm-hmm. It was right. It was never going to get kept in that production because, as they say, that production wasn't really acting; it was acting view, acting adjacent. But it was really remarkable moment. And I remember a lot of those ten. I've since done the production. I don't know, hundreds of performances, which in La Mancha makes you a newcomer. There are guys who've done it 5,000 times. For real, 5,000 times.
Oh, my God.
You know. Lou Criscolo, I think, got a medal when we were in L.A. in 91. The mayor gave him a medal for on the honor of his 3,000th performance as Sancho.
Oh my God.
That didn't even count the thousands he'd done as, you know, the third muleteer from the left.
It's a career.
For some people it is, and for some people they never actually escaped it. The thing about doing Shakespeare is there is room for you in every role and more, you know. And we need, as a community, to develop a more flexible idea about how to cast, you know.
Well, in a way, this refers back to what you were talking about before, about this society having a very rigid idea of what is right and wrong and what is perfect and what is good.
Yes.
And
and right now, a very, very low expectation of what theater can achieve for them. And therefore, they don't recognize that theater is actually essential. They think it's a luxury. And when people say, what do you do? I'm a Shakespeare player. They actually don't know what that means. It takes them a while to process the idea that there is such a profession.
So when did you say, I'm a Shakespeare player? When did that happen?
Well, I think I'd been saying it for a while. I think it was true sometime in the late 80s when I started working with a company called Shakespeare and Company, and I had not done any training since acting school. I'd been just burnt. But I took a workshop with this company. They were soliciting me. They wanted me to join the company, and they had a particular methodology which was associated with a particular voice approach, certain movement things, and a way of approaching the text that was very personal and very passionate.
Perfect for you.
And it happened to be perfect for me.
Right.
We drove together. Tina, who ran the company at that time, I was her principal player for a long time because it was a really good collaboration.
Well, because it fit you so well.
Yeah, and because I fit her.
Yes. Well, that's what I meant,
actually. Yeah, that capacity, my capacity for a combination of extremity and real articulateness and her ability to give kind of unlimited permission and license and a purpose. You know, she, as I am, is very strongly feminist and very passionately feminist. And so to be in a Shakespeare company that isn't passionately feminist is really hard for me because Shakespeare himself, the material, is misogynistic.
Yes.
And so you need a good philosophy to make sure you're not going out doing harm.
Yes.
And we had that. But what they had as a measure of, as part of training, was they were able to take a very analytical player with a lot of technique and turn me into a very improvisational player.
Oh, my God.
And so now all of a sudden, and part of it became because in that company the ethos was that once you knew something, you taught it. And I, in a way of making my teaching not intimidating, I kind of developed a kind of a patter line, a line of, that, and it was funny. And so my ability to be funny in class translated into playing funny roles. And now all of a sudden, there's a whole two-thirds of the plays that I can do.
Yeah.
So at, right at the time when I probably, I was about 32, 31 or 2, I should have maybe shifted to directing in terms of a career.
Right.
All of a sudden, there were roles I could play that I'd never been able to play.
Yes.
And so that I think that's when I became a Shakespeare player, because a Shakespeare player can play Benedict and Dogberry.
Right.
And Lear, I'm giving you examples, you know, that prove my point, you know, Lear and Kent.
I understand.
And, you know, and Antonio and Shylock, which is a really good one. I did Shylock and then Antonio in adjoining months. That's, you know, and then you're a Shakespeare, you know, because there's nothing. And the same thing is true if we're able to unlock our imagination. But in the case of women, it really takes some imagination because the plays are misogynistic in a way.
Yeah.
And the roles just get better for me. What the hell, you know? I mean, I get a little older, I can do Lear more.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a bad gig. But for women, you start running out. You run into Volumnia and maybe Margaret of Anjou. You know, and maybe you can play Adriana into your 50s, but not too many others.
Right.
You know, and so it's, so you need a
Gertrude.
You can play Gertrude. Gertrude's got a son who's 30. How old
is
she?
Yeah, right, so I'm saying. So
yeah,
she
exactly.
Can play her.
She can't be 70.
Right.
You know, So the things that happened back in the turn of the last century, you know, Ellen Terry played Imogen when she was 57. Played Imogen. Mm-hmm. You know, she was playing Perdita in her 50s.
Wow.
16-year-old Perdita. That audience expected a different thing. They expected to open a door and there's the sublime.
Yes.
They didn't expect anything to do with realism. They didn't expect anything to do with the right way to do it.
Yes.
They expected to go...
They were going to get lost.
Yeah. They were going to be careful about...
They were going to be allowed.
They were going to be careful which plays they went to lest they miscarry. Women weren't allowed to see Henry Irving in The Bells if they were pregnant. Because their fear was they would miscarry, and the reason they were afraid is people did.
Really?
Yes, oh yes.
Why?
They were so overwhelmed.
Oh my God.
They got tachycardia, they went into anaphylactic shock,
right,
and they miscarried. Yeah.
That's what happened. So that could happen because people were open, so open,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we need to recreate.
Well, we don't have that here.
Well, we do in selected areas. I just got back from home where they were doing the Fall Festival of Shakespeare, where 10 acting companies get together at Shakespeare and Company and perform for each other.
Mm.
Yeah, they're all high school kids. And when Macduff says, "I have no words," the whole audience says, "My voice is in my sword."
Wow.
You can imagine what an overwhelming experience that is for a Shakespeare player to see that.
Right.
You know, and it's true that that's a little audience. When Thisbe and Pyramus kiss,
yes,
and the chink moves and they actually kiss, the whole audience stands up and cheers that these two guys are kissing. That's the size event that we need to find a way to recreate, you know. And you don't do that by getting it right or by doing it properly. You do that by expecting so much from yourself. You know, what to come back to starting by asking how deep is deep and then going
deeper
than that. You know, otherwise it's what it has become in so many countries, you know, is the poor cousin of film.
Yes.
And we can't do what film does.
But
they can't do what
we do. They can't
do
what you do, no, right. That's right.
And I'm hopeful about it, but I'm very, very worried.
Well, so. I don't think that's inappropriate.
No.
Okay, I asked one more question. I'm just going to ask it. Having given a life to this work, is there anything you would say about what that's like?
You know, it's the only thing wrong with it is the financial insecurity.
Yes.
You know, and the fact that your scope is small. It's the people who actually meet you and the people who meet them. It takes a long time for it to make a difference. It's not like politics or plumbing or television. You're not leveraged strongly. It's individual. It's retail. And you move the people that you meet.
That you move.
And that's one of the great things about teaching is now I have a dozen students, and with luck, you know, there'll be a little wave effect. You know, so that's about the best I can say about that.
You get to have that impact, at least in this area.
Yeah, you don't get to know it, though. That's okay, too.
I think that's true of everything.
It might be. Yeah, it might be.
The most powerful impacts, it seems to me, elude you.
Yeah. I'm sure Mr. Hinckley doesn't know he's responsible for my presence here.
No, right. So right.
I got to go to class. I'm very happy.
Thank you very much for this, John. And we'll come and see the play.
Oh, good. Yeah, it's a pretty good play. You know, they're gonna do a good job with it too.
I'm sure.
It's a pleasure.
And so, even with the financial insecurity and the lack of knowing when you've had an impact and the narrow scope that this life gives you, you can hear in every word he speaks his absolute passion, commitment, and love of what he does. And you can hear the joy, really, that he found it one that he is able to do it. And of course, that's what makes him so good at what he does, and I'm quite sure so good at teaching what he does. So, as you have listened to this, have you looked back on your life? Did someone say to you, wow, you are really good at that. You're a good dancer. You're a good writer. You're a good artist. You could be a good doctor. You could be a good electrician. Did anybody do that for you in the way that Mr. Hinckley did for Johnny? Did you take it seriously? Did you ask yourself, wow, is there a career in this thing that I seem to do naturally, that I love when I'm doing it, that when I'm doing it, I feel at home, comfortable? Are you yourself? Or did you, as so many of us have had to do, think, oh yeah, right, but that doesn't make enough money, or my parents wouldn't like that, or everyone in my family does this, or all my friends are doing this, or people would laugh if I said that this is what I wanted to do. I have a lovely interview with Austin Pendleton in which he talks about how he knew always he was an actor, but knew that his friends would think it was foolish, and so he never told. Or Ian Webb, who is the director of the Sarasota Ballet here, who had to pretend to be a regular boy to get through school because dancing was not something his friends would understand. But both of these people held on to their dream and made it a reality. Did you hold on to yours? And if not, it's not too late. So, it is my hope that this interview inspired you, that the show inspires you. As always, that you got something from this show that will bring you back. Because, as always, I will be back next week, same time, same station. And as always, I sure hope you will be, too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you see my face and figure. I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't